Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon or good evening, wherever you may be. I came across this beautiful reminder that's in the Lotus Sutra that says, the one who bows is the one who is bowed to. You know, every time we do this, and we bow to each other, we welcome each other, we acknowledge each other, remembering the one who bows and the one who is bowed to are the same. We meet each other in this space, and we are very much the same in our, probably very much alike in our desire to be involved in a practice that makes us feel better, basically, right? The bottom line is being in a practice of training that helps us understand the complexity of living this human life. I think that's what we're doing here. So as always, it's such a pleasure to be here. I am calling in from the unceded territory of the Wiat, which is Northern California on the coast in the Redwoods, about 300 miles north of San Francisco. And it's the magic of Zoom, right? That we can all do this. So take a moment, if you will, and if you can turn your video on, do so we can actually see you, and let's look at each other. You know, it's just a way of seeing who's here, and nobody knows who's looking at whom at any given moment. So it's hopefully that would feel comfortable for you. Just take each other in. I love doing this. It's really, it's a sweet thing to do. So the way we will go forward in our morning today is that we'll start here shortly with an arriving meditation, and then I will offer some Dharma thoughts, and then we'll have a longer meditation. We'll have time to talk with each other. I'll offer a little longer Dharma talk, and that's just how our morning will go, and there will be plenty of time for us to interact with each other. Am I forgetting anything that I want to say that we normally say when we start? All right, so bow to yourself. Know that your showing up here today is such a beautiful act of showing up for your life. And if anybody is new to Spirit Rock today, a really big welcome, a really big welcome to you for coming. Or if you haven't been in a while, welcome back. Welcome back. So let's come into our arriving meditation, finding a posture that works for you, sitting in a way that keeps you alert, but not tight, not stressed. Eyes open or closed, whichever suits you. And as you arrive and settle, turning the awareness inward, see if you can get a sense of feeling your body as if from the inside out. What is it like on the inside? And as you do that, settling into a posture that lets you get that feeling of, oh yeah, this feels right. This is comfortable. There may be both pleasant and unpleasant, comfortable and uncomfortable sensations or thoughts or energies, but this is the way it is right now. And from this awareness of both the internal and external posture, becoming aware of the breathing. Nothing special to do, just breathe and know you're breathing. Coming into practice this morning with a sense of, hello me. Hello me. Meeting and greeting and welcoming yourself right at this time. Well, let's sit quietly for a few minutes. as you continue to arrive and settle. If there is anywhere in the body that feels particularly tight, holding, see if you can release a little bit on the exhale. Maybe drop the shoulders, soften the belly, unhinge the jaw. Each breath in is this arriving into right now. Each breath out, a release and a settling. And remembering what brought you here today. What is that motivation, that inspiration that got you here? Maybe this is part of your regular practice that you come every Wednesday. Maybe your schedule just opened up and you had that thought, I can go to Wednesday class. What do you hope for? Why are you here? Do you have an intention? Let that arise. And then coming back into the body. Getting a sense of all of those touch points where your body's connected to the furniture or the ground, the earth, this groundedness of the body. Being aware of this breath, this body, heart and mind. Good morning again. The one who bows and the one who is bowed to are the same. There's so much in that. So as we go forward with our morning, I've been thinking a little bit about my own experience of listening to Dharma talks and being in Sangha. For whether it's a 2-hour session, a 1-hour session, an all-day retreat, a multi-day retreat, and the desire to learn and to really take in what is being offered. And sometimes it's possible to get really caught up, I'm speaking for myself here, in taking notes or wanting to take down every resource, especially if there's something that a teacher offers that feels particularly resonant. Ooh, who said that? What was that quote? I got to get that poem. And I've come to the conclusion through this experience that it is actually distracting to me from being present in the session, no matter how long it is. If I'm focused on, the teacher said something just now that I really want to get that. And that's valuable. It's really valuable when you hear something and you want to get that resource. But I want to offer you another way of thinking about it, which is that to sit in a talk, to sit in a session like this and just enjoy it. Just be here and enjoy it and trust that if there's something that really piqued your interest, you can go back to the talk because they're all recorded and you can listen again and you can get the resource. I've gone back to talks when I wanted to get a quote of something and just rewind and just listen to it so I could write it down. And so I want to make the suggestion that you give yourself over to this time without the concern about what did she say? What was that resource? Because it makes it a richer experience and you can trust that you're going to get what you need. And also, there's a lot to be said for going back and getting a specific resource if it's something that you're interested in. So give that a try. You know, it completely changed my relationship to listening to talks and to being in any kind of Dharma setting, that I could trust my own practice, my own heart, that I would get what I need. And so for that period of time of the session itself, to just be there, just to be fully present. Okay. It's been such a delight to be here the last 2 weeks and to be here for our third session. And we have been talking about various aspects of awareness and compassion the last couple of weeks. And I want to repeat a little bit from last week, this aspect of practice that I think is extremely helpful. And this is this practice of the Anapanasati Sutta, which is mindfulness of breathing. Very, very basic practice. And as I shared last week, I've been listening to Thich Nhat Hanh teach on this. And I've come back myself to these very basic teachings that support me in revisiting fundamentals, revisiting this true practice of begin again. So I want to start with that today so it supports us all and then infuses our meditation, and then that will be the ground for the Dharma talk after the meditation. So my hunch is we all know the experience of getting a stirred up mind, a stirred up heart, the chattery monkey mind, right? I mean, this is just true. This is how it is. And how does our practice of presence, the practice of breathing, the practice of awareness of anything, how does that help to stabilize this stirred up mind? So as I share with you more about this Anapanasati Sutta, I want you to know that if focusing on the breath for you is activating in a way that is not good for you, don't do it. Shift your point of attention, perhaps to sensations in the feet or the hands or the sensation of your bottom being in the chair. Maybe it's sound. Choose a different anchor, but know that what I'm talking about is fundamentally the same, about focusing on one point and how it calms the stirred up mind. So here's a beautiful description of the stirred up mind and what can happen when we bring practice to it. And this comes out of the teachings from the Samyutta Nikaya. In the last month of the hot season, when the dust and dirt is stirred up, a large sudden storm disperses and settles it on the spot. In the same way, when this samadhi due to mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it's peaceful and sublime, a deliciously pleasant meditation, and it disperses and settles unskillful qualities on the spot when they arise. That's a big promise, right? By steadying the mind on the spot, it can settle the stirred up mind. And maybe not on the spot, but maybe for you it does, that when we come back, there's all this stuff going on up here. And then we say, nope, I'm coming right back to this in-breath and the out-breath. And that's all I am paying attention to. All of the static somehow becomes less in the forefront, right? The static, just the volume, it quiets, the volume turns down on it. So here are the instructions on this practice of how do we actually engage the breath? And again, how do you actually engage a sensation to be very present with whatever is happening in this body at this time? So that we start with simply becoming aware of the in-breath and aware of the out-breath, whatever that means for you. You know, where do you feel your breath the most in the body? Maybe you don't. Maybe there is a place, but simply the instruction that says, breathe and know you're breathing. I actually really love that instruction. It's so simple because I don't have to do anything special. I just need to be aware of the in-breath and aware of the out-breath. And when one becomes that present, things tend to get quiet. Things tend to slip away. And then the next step of this is to not only be aware of the breath, but to follow it through all the way, right? The follow through, the beginning, middle, and end of each, the in-breath, the out-breath. Maybe you even notice the pause before the next breath begins. But to become that specific, that precise with your awareness. And maybe that's a metaphor for how do we follow through in anything in our lives. And I do think this is what we are learning. I'll speak generally. I think this is what we are learning from this practice of paying attention to the breath. We're paying attention to our lives right now, a commitment to paying attention to right here. And then the follow through, I will be thoroughly present from the beginning to the middle to the end of whatever the task is. This is the follow through. And then the third part of this sutta is to be aware of the body. And we do that all the time. You know, we can say, where do I feel the breath in my body? Or maybe it's not just specific to feeling the breath in the body. Maybe it's just aware of this body generally. There's another beautiful teaching that I think came from Jack Kornfield's teacher, Munindraji, who said, sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. Sit and know you're sitting, and the whole of the Dharma will be revealed. Which, of course, is a metaphor. If you are present for your life, you will understand. You will be here. Everything will show itself. The truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, the truth of interconnection, the truth of greed and ill will, confusion, the truth of the warm heart, etc. Be aware of the body, be fully present, be fully alive. And when the mind and the body come together at the same time with this depth of awareness, that's being embodied. That's when the practice is alive and embodied. And then, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh gives us these instructions that say, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. And then breathing in, I feel this body. Breathing out, I know this body. And then from the stability of the awareness of the breath and the awareness of the body, he gives us the next instruction. Breathing in, I calm the body. Breathing out, I'm relaxed. And this is another function of how we can suggest to our mind, heart, and body where we want to go. So this sense of calm. Now, I want to be careful and specific with this. I was teaching a class the other day, and we were bringing this in. We were all working with this sutta. And at the end of the class, during the meditation, and oftentimes I will do this, and you might know this because you've been in meditations with me, I will give a prompt periodically. And sometimes the prompt is, notice if there's anywhere in your awareness where there's a sense of calm, a sense of ease or stillness that is arising through this practice of the steadiness of the mind. And let that ease and calm be at the forefront of your mind, so that this practice of developing this steadiness and balance becomes, it's made real. So, you know, I often give that instruction because I give it to myself. So whatever I'm saying out loud in a prompt in a meditation is actually what I say to myself in my own meditations. But at the end of the meditation, somebody said to me, you know, I don't ever feel calm. And so when you said, is there any amount of calm that you feel? I had to think about, why am I not even running out of this room? Why am I staying here? So I share this with you because it can be challenging. We all have different backgrounds. There can be a certain amount of hypervigilance, a certain amount of habit that we actually don't know what this experience of stillness is. But we can do it. We can do it. Just the fact of showing up over and over again. So if I offer an instruction that feels like anathema to your experience, or you feel like this doesn't fit me, let it go. Let my instruction go, not your thought go. You can let your thought go if you want, but within this practice, really work with what is resonating with you at that moment, and then let the rest go. So this is full permission to breathe and know you're breathing, to sit and know you're sitting. And this language of breathing in, I calm the body, you can change that. Breathing in, I'm deciding to stay. Breathing out, I'm going to stay. Is this making sense to you? It's very important to adapt this practice with language that you can relate to. And through this steadiness of mind, through this calming practice of I'm going to stay, there's a way in which over time, a certain amount of joy, contentment, maybe even happiness starts to let itself be known. And I think of that as, oh, I just feel better. Oh, this is nice. And as Thich Nhat Hanh says, can we train to live happily in the present moment, to see that the conditions for contentment are already available? Already available. What can we connect with that is already here? And that's part of the practice too, to try to connect with what is already here. He also says, Thich Nhat Hanh, happiness is available. Please help yourself. It includes each one of us. Please help yourself. And so it's out of that ground that then we have set a strong enough foundation that we might start being able to work with what might be uncomfortable, a painful feeling, a painful energy. Breathing in, I know there's a painful feeling that is coming up in me. Okay, so this is the awareness of what else is happening here. This is what's true. It could be fear. It could be anger. It could be despair or jealousy, those kinds of painful feelings. And he says we have to be there for our pain. We do, if we want to really transform our suffering, transform our reactivity into responsiveness, into compassion and wisdom, we have to be there for ourselves. And you are, because you're here today. You wouldn't be here today unless you wanted to do that, is my hunch. So when a painful feeling arises and you know it, you recognize it, allow it. And he says, there is no fighting to be done, no violence done to our suffering. It's a really important teaching. And all of this can be learned and experienced through this Anapanasati Sutta, which is the brilliance of this, which is the total brilliance. So, through through this steadiness of mind, through the breathing in, I know I'm breathing in, breathing out, I know I'm breathing out, following it all the way through, awareness of the body, making space for whatever is here. It's really important. This is why we're here. And again, I said this last week, and I want to say it again because it's really stuck with me. This experience of suffering and the end of suffering, or working with that which troubles us, stirs up the mind and heart, this is a natural experience. This is the definition of living a human life. And Thich Nhat Hanh went on further to say, you know, the teaching of no mud, no lotus, the lotus that grows out of the mud, make good use of the mud. Make really good use of the mud, because we all have it. And I love that teaching, and I'm bringing it back again today, because this is what we do in the Dharma, right? We, you know, we bring things back over and over again that are poignant, that are important and valuable. And for me, the way I relate to make good use of the mud is, I get it about the things that are troubling in my life or have been. What I really want to know is, what am I learning from this? How am I making good use of the mud? So the question that I use for me personally, for my practice, and I offer to you is, where is this suffering leading? Where is the suffering leading? So whatever makes sense for you, make good use of the mud. What am I learning from this? Where is the suffering leading? You can explore all of that in the steadiness of this body and this breath in this moment. So let's move into our meditation. And I'll offer you a couple of these instructions, and then we'll sit quietly together with a periodic prompt. So please find a posture, again, that you can stay present and alert, yet relaxed. Eyes closed or eyes open, whichever works best for you. If your eyes are open, please have a gentle downward gaze. If your eyes are closed, you might notice shapes or light or shadows behind the eyelids. And begin by coming into contact with your own body, becoming aware of this body at this time, in the posture that it's in. Noticing the touch points, the places where your body is connected to the furniture or the floor, cushion. Maybe the feet in your shoes or your socks, however the feet are. The hands. They're all points of grounding. Getting a sense of the spine, the back body, how the spine grows tall, all the way from the tailbone, up the back through the neck to the crown of the head. And holding just enough energy in the back body to stay attentive and awake, present. And relaxing the whole front of the body, the face, including the jaw and the tongue, all the way down the torso, relaxing the shoulders. So with this stable, strong back and this soft front, there's room to breathe. Sitting and knowing you're sitting, breathing and knowing you're breathing. Aware of the in-breath, aware of the out-breath. Following the breath all the way from the beginning to its end. And you can use these instructions if you like. Breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. Or perhaps breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I relax. And if it happens that a painful thought, emotion, or feeling comes about, knowing you can be with this steady mind, the reliability of this breath helps you to take good care of yourself just as you are. So finding what works for you, where to settle your awareness, the breath, the body, the phrases. Try to stay there. And of course, when the mind wanders, come back and gently, kindly, yet persistently begin again. And let's sit quietly. Again, softening anywhere that's tightened up, if you can. Might be the brow or the jaw, the shoulders or the belly. Maybe clenched hands. Releasing, softening any amount. Sense in. Is there any amount of stillness arising? Settledness of the mind? Maybe a little softening of the heart, a little opening? Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. But still staying with it. Awareness of the body, this breath. Maybe even offering mid-meditation a bow to yourself for showing up and staying. Keep going. And as we continue with our meditation, sensing into what would be helpful for you right now. Stay with the breath, stay with the body. Maybe you're off somewhere else, come back. What does your wisdom tell you would be helpful in this meditation right now? Do you want to move into your own practice of metta and compassion? Sensing into this heart space, perhaps even placing a hand over your own heart so you can feel the warmth of your own body touching itself. Maybe you can feel through the hand on the heart, the coming and going of the breath, the rise and fall of the chest, reconnecting to what is happening right in this moment. And with a kind voice, this internal kind voice, maybe offering yourself this beautiful prayers of well-being. May I be safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be filled with loving kindness. You decide. For this next few minutes, let your practice be exactly what it needs to be. Stay with it. Tap into your own wisdom. Be kind to yourself. So, opening your eyes as you're ready. Okay, let's take 5 minutes and we'll come back 5 minutes from now. If that's whatever, 10 minutes after the hour or so, let's just do that. Take a break and then we'll come back. Thank you, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back, everybody. It's true that this weather has been incredibly challenging, and there's been a lot of loss for a lot of people in this. And in the moment of noticing you're okay. Driving through the valley, getting to the top of the hill, whether it is literal or metaphorical for any of us, and you see what's possible, that sunshine coming through the fog, orange, whatever the color is, even for a few moments, to be present for that is what Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about. The conditions for happiness are already here. We really must notice what that is. And it might be that there are groceries in the house. Might be that the furnace works and it's warm. I mean, it can be all kinds of things. So to notice these moments of happiness that support us is critically important, critically important. And to connect with the natural world any way that you can. And not everybody can go outside. Most of us could look at a picture of something or have a plant. And I mean this, that some way to connect with the natural world is rejuvenating, is really healthy. So I'm just going to do a shameless plug here, since you got me on this path here. On April 23rd, I think it is, if anybody is in my neck of the woods, if you want to come up for a day-long hiking retreat, I'm offering that on April 23rd up in Redwood National Park. And it's on my website under retreats. It'll be a really sweet day long if you feel like doing that. Okay. Noticing the conditions for happiness. What are the things that are okay right now? You know, Rick Hansen is very famous for saying, we're almost always all right right now. We're almost always all right right now. Which brings us into this moment of what is okay right now, even within the midst of what might may be difficult. So last week we talked a lot about compassion. We watched that beautiful video from Megan Devine on refuge in grief, about how to accompany each other through difficult times. And I want to take this now and take us into expanding this natural compassion that we've talked about into how, what it really does is tap into our very deep and abiding natural wisdom that is inside of us, that just like compassion can get covered over, but we learn to trust ourselves. We learn to understand that wisdom is a natural practice. It's not something that we necessarily can do, but it is something that we cultivate. So I was reading a little bit about this scholar. His name is Peter Skilling, and he's got a book called Questioning the Buddha, a selection of 25 sutras that it's actually a hard book to get. I've been trying to get it for a little while, and I'm hoping this, just tried to reorder it again because I'm very curious, you know, questioning the Buddha. I love the practice of questioning. Whatever you hear me say or another teacher say in any realm, when you have that thought, huh, I wonder if that's true. How does that really work? Bringing your own critical thinking into whatever it is such a rich practice of tapping into your own wisdom, not believing something blindly, but saying, how does this work for me? So what he says is that there are four teachings that we should all practice as long as we live. And he says four teachings, this is from the Buddha, that bodhisattvas should practice. So let's take that word bodhisattva and just define that as all of us, anyone who actually is on a path of helping to relieve the suffering of ourselves and others. Every time that we say, may all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering, and it includes ourselves. This is the bodhisattva prayer. So we can use that word bodhisattva, which comes from the Mahayana tradition, and just say practitioner. Let's just say practitioner. We show up and that's who we are. So these four teachings, bodhisattvas should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should maintain spiritual friendships as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should practice patience, openness, and kindness as long as they live. Bodhisattvas should spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness as long as they live. And so what this is pointing to is these aspects of awakening about really developing the skills and the wisdom to live a wholesome life. This is what Pema Chodron says about this. She says, if your everyday practice is to open to all of your emotions, to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter without closing down, trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go. And then you will understand all the teachings anyone has ever taught. And this is this development of this aspiration towards awakening, this cultivation of ethical and emotional intelligence, cultivating this sort of, I think of it as a radical responsibility and a radical decency and integrity. And when I say radical, I don't mean extreme, I mean complete, from the root. So this bodhisattva vow that says, may all beings, including me, be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. And how can I help to make that happen? That very real dedication to being present for our lives. That's what we're talking about. Bodhisattvas should cultivate an aspiration for awakening as long as they live. I love the metaphor that we have sometimes in the Dharma that equates the Dharma to a bird. One wing is the wing of wisdom. The other wing is the wing of compassion. And they're connected in the body, this body of courage that supports the wing of compassion, the wing of wisdom. All of these are a practice of this mature and maturing heart. Mature and maturing heart-mind, they're not separate. Oftentimes in our culture, I know we separate the mind from the heart, from the body. But if you hang out in this practice for any length of time, you start to really know that it's all the same, that there really is no separation from the mind and the heart and how it affects the whole being. And the second one of these teachings, bodhisattvas should maintain spiritual friendships as long as they live. Right, we need each other, right? The Sangha, the way we take refuges and precepts, that we commit to being in a community in which awakening is possible, supported and nurtured by one another. Don't ever stop coming to Sangha. We need each other. Just keep coming, whatever the Sanghas are, right? Just keep doing it. The third one, bodhisattvas should practice patience, openness, and kindness as long as they live. Yes, right? Patience, the ability to abide, to be here right now. My favorite definition of patience is the ability to relax the edges of time so something else can arise in that space. The practices of abiding, the practices of compassion. The last one, bodhisattvas should spend some portion of time dwelling in the wilderness as long as they live. Now you can think of this literally as go outside and connect with nature, yes. But there's also a metaphor here around meditation being the wilderness. This place where we go, where we come to know ourselves so intimately, a place of seclusion, which might be called, you might think of that as the wilderness. It may be a wild place inside. I remember early on in my meditation practice thinking as I was getting started, there was a really vast and wild and woolly landscape inside of me. And it is. Right? I mean, whole worlds exist, whole wildernesses exist inside of us. And our practice is to keep befriending them, to keep knowing them. And with any teaching, Of course, there is the conceptual understanding, oh, that's what this means. And that just stays in a conceptual understanding. But the practice of making it alive is to experience these teachings. What does it mean? What is it like to experience Sangha? What is it like to experience the dedication towards goodness, towards this awakening, understanding our human condition, and putting in place practices and values that support our well-being and decrease our suffering? What is it like to really understand how metta lands for you? What is it like to offer metta? We don't know how it really affects another person, but we know, I think, that it actually changes us. It makes me feel better, and when I feel better, I behave better. All of this understanding and experiencing getting the what makes it meaningful is what leads to an embodiment of these practices, all in the service of wisdom. And this is what I want to talk today about a little bit more, is about wisdom. We're doing all of this in the service of wisdom, because out of this wing of wisdom that is balanced with compassion, connected in this body of courage and awakening, we create a life that is in line with these teachings of non-harming, teachings of doing good in the world, being kind to ourselves, knowing we won't always get it right. We come back and we begin again. The practices of trial and error. So how do we know? How do we know when something is working? Abe Lincoln is famous for saying, "When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad." It's that simple, maybe. And then, of course, all of our filters get in the way. You know, all of our denial systems, all of the ways in which we maybe don't see clearly. So wisdom, discernment, innate clarity, this ethical and emotional intelligence that says that teaches us what we need to do when, right? How to transform reactivity into responsiveness, when to respond. Are you familiar with this beautiful teaching from Nisargadatta that says, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. And in between the two, my life flows. It's an amazing teaching to hang out with and feel it and reflect on it and ask internally about it. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And in between the two, my life flows. So the way I relate to that is, how am I nothing? So we can come into these teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, how we tend to make things more complicated than they already are, how we can stop doing that, and then the path leading to the end of suffering, all of these practices of the Eightfold Path around morality, ethics, awareness, compassion, the truth of the three marks of experience, the truth of impermanence, right? The truth that everything is always, always changing, that there are trees down over here, but the sun is coming out over here. And how can we hold the truth of the joy and the sorrow all at the same time, all within this constant life of change? And understanding the inherent nature of dukkha, that life is challenging no matter what for everybody, and none of us is exempt. And what makes cultivating the wisdom and really understanding in our bones these Four Noble Truths and the truth of impermanence, interconnection, that everything connects to everything else, is these obscurations of greed and ill will and ignorance, delusion. Those three huge categories are what make the cultivation of wisdom and compassion a lifelong practice. Because the truth of greed and ill will is that they keep coming up over and over and over again, right? I want this, I don't want that. I deserve this, I should get that. How hard we work to get what we want, the struggle, the suffering of getting what we want, the struggle and suffering of getting what we don't want, the struggle of suffering of getting what we want, and then it goes away because things change. So the wisdom tells me I am nothing. The way I relate to that and find relief in that is, this is how life is. Of course. Of course. Dukkha is true. Impermanence, the changing of everything. And sometimes things change for the better, sometimes for the worse, sometimes sideways. But just the reality of knowing however it is right now, it will be different. And it is in the process of being different. And when we don't fight that, this is where we go back to what Thich Nhat Hanh says, do not fight your suffering. Or Shinzen Young, who says, do not fight with yourself at any level. This is the development of wisdom. When we know that we are not exempt from everything it means to be alive. But love tells me I'm everything. So how did that happen? That is because, I think, that what else are we going to do? Because life is tenuous, because it's changing constantly, because there's suffering in the world, life is so precious, I better love it right now, because I'm right here, right now. How am I going to make the best of this? How am I going to learn to love myself and you and you and you? Because it's inside of that love, which I know is a fraught word, that compassion can arise, loving kindness can arise, joy, equanimity. So for the wisdom to be supported, the truth of the Four Noble Truths, these four, the impermanence, the greed, the ill will, we need love in order to undo states of greed, to cultivate non-greed, the releasing, the letting go of what is unnecessary, opening our loyalty to our own opinions about things should be a certain way. What happens if we open up a little bit and bring a little kindness to that, a little compassion for ourselves and each other? You know, the beautiful practice of faith in the Buddhist practice, sadha, literally means to place the heart upon, to go in that direction, to have some trust and some confidence in this practice of awareness that cultivates wisdom that is supported by compassion, that is supported by this love. And I really appreciate this succinct teaching from Andrew Olensky, who is a Buddhist scholar and Pali translator. He says, every mindful moment in which generosity displaces greed, compassion takes the place of hatred, and insight dislodges delusion, is a moment in which we are awake. Bodhisattvas need to continue practicing this practice of awakening as long as we live, because it dislodges greed and replaces it with generosity. It dislodges hatred and replaces it with compassion. And it dislodges ignorance and we wake up. So, you know, it's not so easy to, you know, when we think about cultivating wisdom, it's not something that we can do wisdom. Unlike other of these heart practices, we can cultivate metta. We can learn about practices of appreciative joy, mudita, and compassion. But wisdom is not a task. It's not an action. It's a way of being, right? This is something that is inside of us. It's something we have. It's something we are. It's something we become. And you know, the beautiful invocation in many meditations start, oh, nobly born, right there. Oh, nobly born. The Buddha addressed us as nobly born, these wise ones, you who are the sons and daughters of the awakened ones, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Remember who you are, the goodness of your heart, the luminous nature of your mind. Trust it, return to it, it is home. The trust it is where the wisdom gets built. And we trust that through all of these practices. We can tap into older parts of ourselves. If I were 90 years old, what would my 90-year-old self tell me to do when I feel stuck? And we imagine being in the fullness of our wisdom, and actually we have a lot of answers already. I find that to be the case. And it takes courage, right? We take this wing of compassion and this wing of wisdom and embody it in this body of courage when we have the ability to say, what do I know to be true? And it's a big question. Is it a koan? What do I know to be true? And you can ask yourself that. What do you know to be true? I know that, I mean, we can get down to basics about, you know, basic things in our lives, but really, what have you learned? What do you really know? And that is a way to connect to what is meaningful, to truly what is meaningful. I do a fair amount of work with infirm elderly people through a local nonprofit. And after I read the book Being Mortal from Atul Gawande, anybody read that book? Fantastic book. And he does a lot of palliative care. He's a physician, and he's also studied the advent of care homes and what happens to our elderly kin. And how do we keep them feeling vital, and how do we keep seeing them so they know they are alive and important? He's made a practice of saying to people, what's important to you? Or a question like, what's the most important part of your day? What do you love doing? And if somebody says to me, tell me about you, what's the most important part of your day? Or what is the part of your day you love? They're actually asking about me. What are my values? Who am I? What makes me happy? And to do that with a person who is compromised in some way, to know that for them to know they still matter, who they are still matters, to ask that question. So I did that in a group in this clinic. And these are all people who are highly challenged, mostly physically. And one man said, well, most important part of my day, and he leaned back in his chair, and he said, when I wake up in the morning, and before I've turned my light on, and my eyes aren't even open yet, but I can tell there's a little light in the room, he said, that's the most important part of my day, because I'm waking up again. I'm waking up again. You know, you can ask yourself that. What is meaning-making for you? And then all these things about the Four Noble Truths and the greed, ill will, and delusion, and impermanence and interconnection, they all start making a lot of sense, because they are all really true. This is something that we come to know. What do I know to be true? The Four Noble Truths are true. Impermanence is real. You can go through all these different teachings and work with them yourself of how do you know they're true? How do they come alive for you in your own life? Here's a poem. You know, there's a whole history of Japanese death poems. And there are books called Japanese Death Poems where people write their pithiest understandings at the end of their lives. And here's one from Kozan Ichikyo from the 14th century. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple things happening that get entangled. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple things happening that get entangled. So we are working out this entanglement, aren't we? That's what this is. This is our practice that works out this entanglement. And in fact, the Buddha talked about untangling the tangles. And I don't know where in the teachings it is, but he talks about untangling the tangles. So that when we come to the end of our lives, that we actually can say, thank you very much, I have no complaints. That's a famous line from Charlotte Jokelbeck, I think, who was a Zen teacher. Thank you very much, I have no complaints. So there are other questions that I like to use for cultivating wisdom. I call them compass questions that I think are useful for putting me back on track. You know, and they come from a few different places. One question that does come from the Buddha, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? What when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? This asks us to take the long view, helps us modulate impulsivity, and also tap into wisdom. These are wisdom questions. Also to ask yourself periodically, what have I learned lately? What have I learned lately? Or to sit down with a friend and say, what have you learned lately? It's a rich conversation. Not only what is something important to you that happens in your day, but this is another way of saying, so what's new? But let's get a little deeper than, hey, how are you? What's new? Have you learned anything lately? Here's something that I'm working on. It's a really fun question. What makes you tick? What makes your heart sing? And this goes to an old story where I first started really thinking about this years ago, was hearing the story of Howard Thurman, and you may know this, who was an activist theologian in the Bay Area and started, I think, the first interfaith, interracial church in San Francisco in the 60s. And he had a training for activists, for young activists. And the story goes that at the end of this training, one of his students came to him and said, okay, I finished the training. Now what should I go do? And the story goes that he says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs are people who have come alive. This is the Bodhisattva intention. We're all different from each other. But what makes you come alive and what makes me come alive and all of us, we need our aliveness. We need our passions. So do that. Ask yourself, what makes my heart sing? And then have the courage and the wisdom to go do it. And what makes you reverent? What brings out awe? Like, where is the place where your breath stops? You say, oh my God, that's so beautiful. Right? Getting to the top of the hill and seeing the sun peeking through and knowing it's important to notice that. Connecting to love. That's what this is. So I want to end with a poem called Self-Compassion. It's from James Cruz, one of my favorite poets. My friend and I snickered the first time we heard the meditation teacher, a grown man, call himself Honey, with a hand placed over his heart to illustrate how we too might become more gentle with ourselves and our runaway minds. It's been years since we sat with legs twisted on cushions, holding back our laughter. But today I found myself crouched on the floor again, not meditating exactly, just agreeing to be still, saying, honey, to myself each time I thought about my husband splayed on the couch with aching joints and fever from a tick bite. What if he never gets better? or consider the threat of more wildfires, the collapse possibly of the Gulf Stream, then remembered that in a few more minutes I'd have to climb down the cellar and empty the bucket I placed beneath the leaky pipe that can't be fixed until next week. How long does any of us really have before the body begins to break down and empty its mysteries into the air? "Oh, honey," I said. For once, without a trace of irony or blush of shame, the touch of my own hand on my chest, like that of a stranger, oddly comforting in spite of the facts. What else are you gonna do? Oh, honey. And I love this place where we're invited into practice, and James says, "My friend and I snickered the first time we heard the meditation teacher, a grown man, call himself honey." Like, what is that? What are our resistances to these practices that ask us to love ourselves? Maybe harder for men than women, maybe not. And at the end of this, he's calling himself honey. Okay, yeah, this is how hard it is to live a life, afraid of losing his husband. But he's got to go fix the leaky pipe anyway, right? This is the wisdom. Everything is changing. I don't know what's going to happen. I have to stay in my life. I've got to do these regular things. And I got to love myself anyway. And oh, honey, it is hard to be a human. Then let's offer up the goodness of our time together to know that what we do matters. It's important. We are all wise, loving beings, and we can learn to tap into that. Let yourself feel your goodness. Oh, honey. Oh, honey. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering, and that includes us. Thank you, everybody. I'll be back next month. We'll see you then. Thank you.